All right. It's a Taylor Report, CIT, and I don't know if we have Tony on the line yet. Oh, yes, we do. Are you there, Tony?
I am, Phil.
I'm proving how we produce on air. Well, first of all, congratulations again on the book. It's going to be coming out. The publication date is November the 1st. Title is The Truth About the 37 GM Strike, which is a legendary strike in Canada. And you're going to have a book launch. I'll do all this. At a different book list Wednesday, October 30. So that's, and there'll be books available, I assume.
Yes, break them out.
Yep. And 779 Bathurst, October 30, 7 p.m., 779 Bathurst Street, Toronto. And again, the title is Truth About the 37 GM Oshawa Strike. And the author is Tony Leah, and we're talking with Tony right now. By the way, Tony, there's some more and more interest in unions. You were at an event the other day. There's another new book. So Unifor is getting a lot of attention. I should say auto workers are getting a lot of attention.
Auto workers are getting a lot of attention. Unions in the auto industry have been extremely important in the U.S. and Canada, of course, in the last couple of years in particular. The book launch that I was at Friday is for Shifting Gears, which is by a couple of professors, Stephanie Ross and Larry Savage, looking at the history of the Auto Workers Union in Canada and its political strategy, so how it's shifted from supporting the NDP, which it did historically for a long period of time, and then shifting to strategic voting, and more recently to a rather apolitical approach that you could describe in the terms that are usually used to refer to gompers of rewarding friends and punishing enemies and making deals, basically. So I haven't read the book yet, but the description of it sounded very interesting. I'm looking forward to reading that.
How about we make a bargain with you that you finish reading it and you can review it and talk about your book too?
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you today about a couple of things. So the we've been talking about electrical vehicles, EVs, and you have been a strong voice on this subject, saying it is and has to be the future, both for the planet and for the industry. There's been a number of problems been emerging. Part of it is the protectionism coming from the U.S., with Trump being the most vocal, saying, and I remember when he was, at the time he was president, he said, trade wars are easy to win. And I wonder if that's so. But at any rate, everybody is buying in. And by the way, how about that? He's the vanguard of saying this. And now you have the Canadian government saying they're going to slap 100% tariff on Chinese vehicles. And the Financial Times reports that the U.S. now wants to ban the vehicle itself. Not put a tariff on. They want to say that it might be espionage. Now we've discussed this with you in the past, but I think many people think, well, this is just going to be a momentary thing. But it seems to be a deepening commitment to a desperate policy. Can you talk about that and why that it isn't wise?
Sure, I think you're absolutely right. And of course, Trump in his first term did target China with some tariffs and other measures. But the Biden government's gone even further. It's the Biden government that introduced 100% tariff on Chinese-built electric vehicles. And now both parties in the U.S. are vying with each other to see who can announce the most draconian measures against Chinese-produced vehicles or materials, including, as you said, just banning them outright, regardless of, you know, not even having tariffs, but just banning them. And they've even talked about banning vehicles that are produced in Mexico by Chinese-owned companies. So it just gets worse and worse.
Yeah.
And it's very retrogressive on a number of grounds. Clearly, most people recognize that there is no future for humanity if we continue emitting carbon and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere at the rate that we're currently doing. And it's not slowing down. Electric vehicles are not the sole solution to that problem, but they certainly are a step in the right direction, especially if they're combined with enhanced public transit systems to get away from individually owned vehicles altogether. And on all of those grounds, China is ahead of everybody. There's no dispute. They are way ahead of everybody in the world at introducing solar power and wind power and electrifying vehicles. I think 50% of the vehicles that are sold in China right now are already electric, and that's increasing every year, and expanding things like high-speed rail. In 10 years, they've gone from 0 to 45,000 kilometers of high-speed rail. It's far, far in the, ahead of all of the rest of the world combined.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're being portrayed as the enemy. It's pretty bizarre.
Yeah, the subversive trick of being successful.
That's right.
Yeah.
For all of their rhetoric, capitalist ideologues always talk about, you know, the value of competition.
Absolutely.
But when they're getting beaten, they don't believe in it anymore.
It's very interesting, apropos of that, that this, I was looking at this piece in Financial Times. I got it from a writer who focuses on China's development and their economy, Andre Arnault. And he says, U.S. has got it backwards. He said, China didn't have an auto industry, and they brought in Western companies and allowed them to build and compete with each other, and then they themselves began to build cars. But they started with a base of competing Western automakers, and then they themselves became part of joined the competition.
That's and exactly right.
It's almost a textbook kind of capitalist claim that, competition is good for you. And you say, it is. It turns out that it is good for you. So why don't you do it?
It is with a twist. And they didn't have tariffs. You know, they invited in, as you said, companies from around the world to produce vehicles, to expand vehicle access for Chinese people. But they did have overall government planning. And one of the things that's being complained about is that they built infrastructure and invested in research and development and had overall planning about what they wanted to achieve. Those are good things that don't happen in North American capitalism. And, the results have been good for the public in China. And they were good for the American and European car manufacturers for a number of years.
Yeah.
But they were arrogant about it. General Motors used to brag that they could just turn an automatic profit of $2 billion in China every year, which they did, without having to strain themselves, just because they could sell Buicks and people wanted to buy Buicks, and they rested on their laurels. And now nobody wants to buy a Buick in China anymore because there are much better, cheaper, more advanced, technically, vehicles that Chinese manufacturers have figured out how to manufacture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one last point under that. The name Tesla comes up, and they're kind of a special story here. When all these things are talked about, the tariffs and all that, Tesla always kind of seems to be in the wings, not all the language applies to them. But so one thing I read about them is that I didn't know that they have a gigafactory. Of course, I didn't know what a gigafactory was. I assume you do. And in Shanghai, and they half of the cars they now produce are
from Shanghai.
From Shanghai.
50%. There's something like 40,000 Teslas in Canada that were manufactured in Shanghai. I read that number somewhere. I hope it's accurate. But a lot of the Teslas sold in Canada are assembled in Shanghai.
It's going to be very interesting to see now that they've introduced McCarthyism and madness, looking for espionage, whether or not they will start looking at Tesla or at individuals who travel back and forth to see if they've got a chip put in the back of their head.
This is where
we are with American foreign policy. Go ahead.
The espionage claim is really bizarre, of course, and you can't accept it if you think about it. How does it make sense to say that a vehicle assembled in China is a security risk and not a vehicle assembled in the United States? I mean, obviously, you were talking about it earlier, supply chain issues that are compromised by governments like Israel can be dangerous and can be used in dangerous ways, and those are real issues. But
maybe you're on to something which would probably make it worse, but that is perhaps they're projecting.
The claim that anything assembled in China is a national security risk is evidence-free. There's no evidence of that.
Yeah. By the way, that used to be the clinching argument of the true paranoid. There was a famous liberal journalist named Walter Lippmann, and he was on the case at the beginning of World War II saying that the Japanese Americans had to be rounded up because they were suspicious. They were Japanese Americans. And so someone said, but Walter, there's no evidence of any of this. And he says, that shows you how serious the problem is.
Yeah.
And you say,
And that's the case with the claims against China right now. And we haven't mentioned it yet, but we talked about it earlier, that the union representing a lot of auto workers in Canada, Unifor, has echoed all of these evidence-free claims against China and supported the 100% tariff and a bunch of other measures, including claiming that there's security concerns. Here's a quote from Unifor's submission to the Canadian government when they were considering what to do about China. And they say that concerns that connected vehicles systems will establish links with EV charging and city traffic management networks, in addition to vehicle-enabled self-driving features, raises serious risks of espionage and sabotage. So you better not get in a vehicle that's been assembled in Canada, or it might turn into a, I don't know what. It's bizarre, and there's no evidence of that.
And again, isn't that, and who are they relying on? Does Unifor have a department that does its own homework, or do they simply take handouts from states?
The 26-page document that they produced is full of footnotes, and they all reference anti-communist or anti-Chinese NGOs, groups like Human Rights Watch, Bloomberg. They are very biased.
These are outfits financed by the Human Rights Watch, gets its money from the State Department, most of its money.
Yeah, and they quote quite a bit from it in this document. Those are their only sources. I think I mentioned before, if you read this document, you could easily believe it had been produced by the United States State Department. That's how it reads. It doesn't read like a union pro-working class document. It doesn't call for public ownership. It doesn't It supports all the Canadian government subsidies to corporations that have been given with no strings attached. Those benefit corporations. There's no evidence that it benefits workers. They, yeah. You know, the billions and billions of dollars that have been given don't require even union representation for the facilities that are being built.
Now, here's a developing country with an industrial power. It's a member of the World Trade Organization. Why wouldn't Unifor call for them to tell the Canadian government to cool the rhetoric with China, do business, and call on the Chinese automakers to build plants in Canada the way they go out of their way to say, well, give GM a ton of money to make some batteries. Why don't they say the same for China? I know this sounds like from another world, but it seems reasonable.
It's more than reasonable. It would benefit all of us, and it would reduce tensions in the world and promote peace, which would benefit all of us as well. But they have this, you read through these arguments and you can be struck by the completely contradictory arguments that are made. So at the one hand, they say that China is guilty of overproduction because they are exporting vehicles. And at the same time, they argue against allowing Chinese companies to manufacture vehicles in North America, including Mexico, where they are setting up. And they're saying that's bad because they would use Mexico as a backdoor. How can you can't have it both ways, logically. But there's very little logic to the arguments.
I can remember, you probably can, Brian Mulroney with his arms spread, and he said, Canada is open for business.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, well, what's this about a backdoor? Why isn't that? Why haven't we opened the front door? What about the issue? Are you aware whether or not Unifor has even thought about asking? How about building some of these plants here? Because it's a very, by the way, their prime electric vehicle maker, is it BY something?
I forget. BYD.
BYD. It's a successful company. Why is there no discussion at all about?
None.
It's like you can't take it up.
Because if you read through the position of the leadership of Unifor, it really is about defending the corporations that they have partnerships with. And that's who benefits from the policies that they're putting forward more than anybody. It's Ford Motor Company, General Motors, Stellantis, which is...
That's a very narrow view of what an auto worker should be and what they should want. I mean, you're saying that they're like a department of the company.
It amounts to...
What was the line
from
the 1950s? What's good for General Motors is good for America, right?
That's right. What's good for GM is good for the country. We're really in that kind of mindset where we have to do what GM, Ford, and Stellantis want because that's how we will benefit. And the long-term result of that is to give those corporations incredible power over what happens in our country. And it's not their country. They don't care about this country or workers here or communities here. They care about their profits. And yet they get to make the decisions that have huge impacts on our communities.
Yeah, they closed your plant without, just pull the plug.
And they could do it again.
And then they rattled it like a box full of marbles and created a new plant.
Yep,
and
with all new workers at lower wages, coincidentally. And we've seen it even more recently than that, where Unifor negotiated with Ford that the Oakville plant, an historic plant in Ontario, would be converted to electric vehicle production. And Canadian and Ontario government put up hundreds of millions of dollars towards that. And after it was shut and closed and everybody was laid off, Ford said, oh, we've changed our mind. We're going to push that back for 3 years so people can stay on layoff for 3 years. And there was a lot of unhappiness about that, needless to say. And the end result was that Ford and Unifor agreed that they would only keep the plant closed for 2 years, but when they opened it up again, it would be to produce what they call super duty trucks. These are the biggest, heaviest duty gas-powered pickup trucks, and with about half the number of jobs. So they get to make that decision. You know, the commitment to electric vehicles has evaporated, and the Oakville plant will be one of several plants that Ford has making these Super Duty trucks, and the first one to be closed if the sales of those vehicles decline. Yeah. Because Ford, they've given Ford the power. We've given Ford the power to make those decisions. Our governments have no influence there. These, you know, there's been no strings attached to all of the subsidies that have been given.
Yeah, the strings, I guess, go from General Motors to the top, the heads of the government.
The other way, yeah.
Yeah, what can we do for you is their position.
Yeah. I wanted to briefly mention that a couple of other things that the Unifor position paper says are worth us thinking about. The first thing they say is that the problem with production in China is that it's a low-wage jurisdiction. They say China is, by all accounts, a low-wage jurisdiction. And, you know, that's why we have to have tariffs or other restrictions against production in China. Well, I don't know that they have looked into it. I briefly looked into it, and what I saw was that, and everybody knows, of course, that the standard of living in China has been increased tremendously over the last couple of decades, and poverty has been eliminated. But in terms of wages, the ILO, which I think is considered to be an international organization with some validity in their statistics, showed that average wages, average urban wages in China over a long period of time have been increasing by 9% a year. I don't think that wages in the United States or Canada for workers have been increasing by 9% a year.
No.
I think people would kind of like that. And in the current wages in China, 2023, according to the ILO, are 121,000 Chinese yuan, which is the equivalent of about $23,000 annually Canadian. That doesn't sound like a low-wage jurisdiction to me.
Yeah, and by the way,
honestly, in purchasing power, and economists talk about purchasing power parity in order to better compare wages in different countries because what you can buy with those wages varies.
Mm-hmm.
In purchasing power parity, the average wage in China translates to $46,000 annually Canadian.
Yeah. Again, these people seem to be working just from some kind of whether you check the box, they don't do any, there's no actual independent research by the union, nor do they don't engage in polemics about how we could improve the situation other than to endorse tariffs, right?
That's right. Or any other measure. They said they would support any measure against China. I would like to see unions in North America have more contact with unions and workers in China and go and find out for ourselves. Why don't we go and investigate it and have a look at their working conditions, their standard of living,
Well, that might lead to terrible things like peace and understanding. You realize what you're saying. I mean,
I do.
They turn out to be human beings like us and all that, and family, schools, sports.
It's almost subversive. The other thing that Unifor has bought into, again, and it's along the same lines of taking what is being said by U.S. government and agencies that, without critical thought, and that's to accuse China of human rights abuses in Xinjiang, and they should find the quote here. What Unifor says in their submission, if I can.
Well, on that. You absolutely put your finger on it. I'm sure, actually, that there are probably people who have been Unifor members, Autoworks, what have actually been to Chenyang.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a hidden away place on the earth. There's millions of people. And all the Unifor is doing is tailing Washington and Ottawa, who are smearing them, because actually standard of living amongst the Uyghurs, we know, has gone up by all the metrics and by people who do this work professionally rather than politically. Nutrition, length of life, quality of life, all of that has improved.
Yeah.
And they're stuck with this Cold War mantra, which could have been written by Joe McCarthy.
Yes. So here's the quote in the Unifor submission. Charges against China include arbitrary detention, torture, mass surveillance, cultural and religious persecution, as well as forced labor, both inside and outside of the region, involving government-backed forced labor transfers. And then they have a quote from Human Rights Watch and talking about the aluminum industry. And, I don't know how deeply you want to get into it. I know a little bit about the aluminum industry. I've visited the one of the major aluminum smelters in Canada, in Kitimat. It's far northern BC. And you would have to ask yourself, why are we smelting aluminum in far northern BC? In fact, they created the community to build the smelter there. And they bring the ore, the bauxite ore, to smelt the aluminum from Australia. And why did they do that? It's not because of low wages. Aluminum production has a very low labor content, actually. It's highly skilled work, generally well paid. But the deciding factor is electricity. They smelt aluminum in northern BC because they have access to cheap electricity. And there are aluminum smelters in Xinjiang because they have cheap sources of electric power. It's got nothing to do with wages. But you know what Human Rights Watch says? They say it's impossible for companies to credibly investigate allegations of forced labor in the aluminum industry in Xinjiang. They say they can't properly investigate it. Therefore, what should happen? Car companies should instead map their supply chains and disengage from any supplier found to source parts or materials from Xinjiang. So you can't use aluminum that has any components from Xinjiang, which produces about 10% of aluminum in the world right now, because we can't certify that, that there's no forced labor in it.
Yeah.
And then Unifor goes even further than that, and in their recommendations, they have a recommendation. And I'm going to find here in a second that the Canadian government ought to. Power.
Yeah.
Here it is. they say it's simply implausible in most cases to expect definitive evidence of forced labor in goods to be presented to customs officials responsible for enforcement.
So there you go.
Therefore, it is important to enforce such laws. Canada follow the approach taken by U.S. customs officials enabling them with withhold.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to go at this point. But we do appreciate it, and it shows that the Unifor is as bad at Cold War as the government. Taylor Report, CIAT. Thanks, Tony Leah.
Bye-bye. Okay, thanks, Phil. Bye.